my little note. Hi, everybody. My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Polly.
By God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977, and for that, I am eternally grateful. Thank you, thank you. I have a home group, and that's Monday night, Third Legacy meeting in Bellingham, Washington. We meet at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in Bellingham, please join us. Love to have you. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and those are the things that I need to be a member in good standing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so thrilled to be here. Andrew, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it so much, and I'm so excited to be here with the people who are speaking. It's just, it's fabulous. To Larry and Rosie, Larry and I used to be in the same home group, and that's been, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see you. I wanted to think how Rosie was talking about last night when all those people gathered at the airport. I'd never seen that either. I was absolutely beside myself. I'm looking around. I'm saying, I don't believe this. I do not believe this. All these people, you guys make people feel so special. Thank you so much for all of those who took time out of their day to come over there and greet people. What a great idea. It's wonderful. Thank you. And I was supposed to be here last year. My husband and I were supposed to be here last year. And those of you who were here last year got to meet Dave because he came. I had to, my mom was ill, and in the meantime, she died in April. So I thank you so much for allowing me to come back. So that I didn't get to come last year, that you let me come this year. So thank you so much. It is an absolute pleasure. I am hosted by this cutest little dynamo that's about this high, Teresa and her husband Ray. And we went yesterday driving around, seeing stuff and sightseeing, and they have this big old truck. I can barely get in it. It's so big. And here's this little midget, you know. So we had a great time. We went sightseeing yesterday up to the ski lift and the ski resort, and it's been a great time. So thank you for your hospitality and allowing me to be here. I'm going to do a workshop this afternoon called Emotional Sobriety. And I got most of the information and most of the stuff that I, an idea, let's put it this way. The information I've gotten is from the big book. I've used the big book, the 12 and 12, As Bill Sees It, and the Al-Anon ODAT. So those are, I just want you to know that when I do a workshop, I do the very best I can to reference AA approved material, even though I've thrown in an ODAT a time or two. And, but I try to use our material. I try to give you my opinion, but I try to use all the material. And, this article, Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier, Bill wrote, and it's in the language of the heart. And he wrote it in 1958, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have the book with me. I just did a printout, so I didn't have to put the book in my suitcase. And I know exactly when I got that book. I got the book. It was a gift from speaking in 1989 because the committee wrote the date and everything in the book. So that's how I know when I got it. And, you know, when you get a gift, it's nice that you, you know, read it. So so I started reading The Language of the Heart, and I came up on this article. And a little history with me. I am one of those alcoholics who is not a party girl. I wasn't out there having a party, you know, having affairs. I did all those sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just was someone who was so depressed, and I just absolutely could not suit up for life. I used to pick up everything I could read on Bill W. because he suffered from depression. And I'm one of those people that I know without a doubt that alcohol and drugs saved my life until I could get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm a person who has tried many times to take my life. And the last time when I was court committed to treatment before I got sober was the last time I tried to take my life. But it certainly had not been the first time. And I was one of those people that would cut on myself, because if I cut on myself, it seemed like I could stand the emotional pain better than the physical pain. And the depression stayed with me into sobriety. And I just couldn't understand. I thought, gosh, I'm working this program. I'm sponsored. I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to do. I'm working the steps, I'm sponsoring people, I'm into service. Why do I still have those feelings of depression and these ideas? Even though I wasn't acting on it, I would still have these suicidal thoughts. And I just didn't understand why that was happening for me. So when I started reading this in 1989, now I got sober in 1977. So I am 12 years sober, and I'm still having these thoughts. Now, I'm not acting on any of them, and I'm still being real depressed. And it's everything is, I mean, I'm having to have a lot of sponsorship just to get moving sometimes. But I continue to do what I'm doing, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm being faithful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found this article. And it saved my life. It was a life-changing article for me. Now, it may not do anything for any of you, but what it did is it brought me into the idea of I have got to constantly stay involved in steps 6 and 7. I have got to keep a look at my character defects at all times, and I also have to maintain a total and a complete dependency on God. Because what this article begins to talk about is faulty dependencies and how I can't have my dependencies on anything but God. And I'm just going to kind of highlight this article in case maybe just by chance some of you aren't familiar with it. And if you are, it's one of my favorite books. If you haven't read Language of the Heart, it's some of Bill's finest writings. And it's his articles that he wrote to the Grapevine. So it's a good book. So, and it's AA approved literature. Okay. I'm not a psychobabble or into any kind of, I may read some of those hokey books, but I don't talk about them from the podium. He starts off by saying that I think that many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Now, one of the things that I want you to know is when Bill wrote this letter, he was coming up on his 24th AA birthday. So he was not new when he wrote this. Perhaps they will be spearheaded for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say humility in our relationships with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romances, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life when we are 47 or 57. Since AA began, I have taken immense swallows in all these areas because of my failure to grow up. And that began to look at, I began to look at that and to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep on depending the impossible, and how very painful to discover finally that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. Now, I don't know if there's any perfectionists in this room. But it's really hard to keep expecting the impossible. And when that doesn't happen, the disappointment that comes with that. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result and so into easy, happy, and good living. That's not only the neurotic's problem. It's the problem of life itself for all of us who have had to go to the point of real willingness to hold to right principles in all our affairs. Even then, as we hoe away, peace and joy will still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA Ulsters have come to, and it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've got to get down in there and get into the causes and conditions and find out. And I believed that I had done that. But what came to me is if I am in this kind of a situation, I need to take, something's wrong. And I began to see that for myself. I recently, and this is what got my attention, and also in the book, on the letter in the book, it says that in squiggly letters, it says that a letter that Bill W. wrote to his friend who was suffering depression. So that got my attention. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn's depression, having no really rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. And that was me. My life was perfect. How come I was, you know, what was wrong? Why was I having these depressions? I began to get scared and that I was in for another long chronic spell. And if you're sitting here and you've never had depression, God love you. I am so grateful. But if you have had, then you know what I'm talking about. Considering the grief that I've had with depression, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw, as I always had always been dependence. Almost absolute dependence on people, circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams and specifications, I had fought for them, and when defeat came, so did my depression. Was depending on other people, places, and things. I'm just going to read just a few more because I'm just going to highlight it because Bill goes in to talking about how he's had, you know, he had worked the 12 steps and that he had had relief and such as that. And he goes on to, because I have over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so strictly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found that I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty dependencies upon people, upon AA indeed, upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. My dependency had to be upon God. And that was what I realized for myself. What had happened was, is I was so dependent upon what people thought of me. And it was a long time. It was not until really 1993 till I really came to grips to how it's not important what people think of me. And that came to grips when Dave and I ended up having a lot of financial problem. And those of you who were at the Wednesday night meeting when I spoke there, in 1993, my husband and I ended up losing everything when the bottom fell out of aerospace in Southern California and suffered some huge humiliation and behind having to lose our home and file bankruptcy. And I'm telling you, my husband couldn't find a job in the United States. And it was just a devastating time. And all I kept thinking about is, what are people going to think of me? You know, we're 16 and 17 years sober, and here we are. I mean, they're going to wonder what step we're working when all of these things are happening to you and you can't put it together. And there's a man by the name of Frank Honeycutt. And Frank Honeycutt is in the big meeting in the sky now, and he was the finest man I have ever known. And Frank was so loving and so caring. And Frank looked at me and he says, "You know something, darling? It is none of your business what anybody thinks of you. But your very life depends on what you think of them." And it was beginning then that I had to let go of what you thought of me. And I had a lot of dependencies. I realize that today. I had a lot of dependencies. I had a lot of dependencies on the things I had. You know, like a house and money. And, you know, there was a lot of dependencies going on. And so this all, even though I had started this workshop in 1990, in 93, it really, and between 93 and 95 is when all of it began to come together. And I began to see things happen that were wonderful. I know I was sharing with Dick, and during that period of time, I will never, ever forget it. And Dick looked at Dave and I and said, "You know what? You can come live in our basement, and we'll put you to work. Don't worry about it." And, you know, it was those kinds of things that get you to have faith that you can keep going on and that you can continue no matter what's going down. Those are the things that are so wonderful. And to trust God that it's going to be okay. And I remember Dave looking at me and saying, "You know something, Polly? If, you know, what we started quoting this little thing, you know, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger." And he said, "You know, Polly, Janis Joplin sang a song that Kris Kristofferson wrote, and it was, I guess it was Bobby McGee, wasn't it? His freedom's having nothing left to lose." And Dave says, "You know, we can lose it all, but we have God, we have AA, and we have each other." And so we started to see that our dependency had to be on God and that He would bring us through this no matter what. And this is what this is what Bill is trying to say, is that I have to give up all my faulty dependencies. And when I can start to give up my faulty dependencies and give up my character defects and be really willing to take a look at them and be honest with myself, I can begin to start to have some sense. Now, I didn't say have it, but some sense of emotional sobriety, that I can begin to know that peace and serenity that comes with having emotional sobriety. Now, I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I got that 100%. But you know that I don't. And but I just wanted to share that letter with you. And I didn't read it all. It's about 3 pages long. Please help, you know, please read it. It's a wonderful piece of literature that we are given. And, you know, that's what's so wonderful about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have so much fabulous literature available to us. So avail yourselves of it. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. What I'm going to talk about is some things that I'm going to just take a few quotes here that help us to have emotional sobriety and be willing to give up faulty dependencies. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I understand from AA trivia and different writings that somebody asked Bill, "Would you want to change any word in the big book?" And he said, "Yes, if I would have changed any word, I would have changed rarely to never." And I really believe that. If we do what we're supposed to do here, then we won't fail. We won't fail. And that's why I love seeing people that have long-term sobriety. I want to see people ahead of me still doing the deal, still coming to meetings, still sponsoring people, still showing up for AA commitments. I want to see people with long-term sobriety doing that. I need that. You know, I need somebody ahead of me. One of the things that I think is very, very, very profound is found in the 12 and 12. And it says, it is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. So no matter, doesn't matter what's going on. It does not matter what's going on. Whatever it is, it's me. It's either my reaction to it or my perception of it. Whatever, it has something to do with me. It is nobody else but me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some character defects. And the first time I did this workshop, I used the character defects as like taking a drink. You know, because sometimes when we act out our character defects, it's like taking a drink. I mean, we look in the 12 and 12, and you know, there's nothing like, it talks about an emotional hangover. I mean, I can get so caught up in my emotions that I can wake up the next day or stay awake all night. That's my thing. It's not about waking up. It's, I mean, I'm one of these people that has problems sleeping. So I'm always saying, oh my God, here I am, almost 29 years of sobriety, and I still have such obsessions of the mind. I have got this busy head that refuses to go to sleep. You know, it always wakes up before me. It just stays awake. But it's like that emotional hangover, you know, that you wake up and you feel like you've been drunk all night. And it's because of what we've done to ourselves. And what I'm going to do is look at some character defects. Now, there's a lot more character defects, okay, around there. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you my glaring character defects, because that's the only ones I know to deal with, is the ones that I have and that I have, that I usually, in my 10th step, a lot of times continue to surface. And I love what the seventh step prayer, when we pray the seventh step prayer, it says, God will remove the defects of character which stand in the way of his use of my usefulness to him. And so sometimes I think, I just hope and pray these will hurry up and stop being useful, because I would sure like to be completely rid of all of them. Okay, so let's look at anger, and the first one's anger, so we're going to look at this like it's a drink. And I had a lot of fun writing these, so so I'll kind of read them with you, and it was fun to do. A deadly poison to sanity and serenity, a special punch to those who want to be God in their lives. Its impact succeeds in obliterating reason and self-control. One can enjoy being a human hurricane when plunged into the depths of this emotional intoxicant. Sometimes the debris left after the storm is staggering. Now, I would love to tell you that I don't get angry anymore. I think I can honestly say that there has been some progress. At least today, I am not standing ragefully having a stomping temper tantrum, which I used to do. That's the kind of anger I used to have. And I'm one of these people that, you know, I want people to like me, okay? I want you to think well of me. So I'm one of these people that would get really angry and rageful, especially if I did something for you and you didn't appreciate me appropriately. You know, has a tendency to boil me up a little bit. And what I would do is I would go home and I would take that anger and rage out on my two little boys. But see, to the rest of the world, I look so nice. And I was one of these people, and my sons reminded me when I got sober that this is a thing I would do. I would come in screaming, like, I don't know if you have teenagers or whatever, but, you know, be gone all day and come in, and if there's dishes in the sink or something like that, just come in and start. Just start. And some of this was after sobriety. I'd love to say sobriety cleaned all that up immediately. But just start raging and yelling and, you know, what makes you think you can live here and make that kind of mess and on and on and on and on. And then the phone would ring and I'd go, hello. And, you know, my sons would sometimes, you know, they said, you know, what is it with you that you treat everybody else better than us? And I began to take a look at some of the anger. The solution: if just one whiff of anger sets up the compulsion to act on it, practice total abstinence and restraint of pen and tongue. And that's page 91 in the 12 and 12. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. Now, I would love to tell you that I am a person who can afford anger, but I'm not. I can't afford it because I'm a person, if I start getting angry, I don't know what it does. It takes a life of its own. It just takes a life of its own. And by God's grace in this program, I have, and practicing a lot of step 11, just learning to be quiet. A head like mine, I've had a hard time learning to be quiet. But what happens is the more I do that, the better I'm able to deal with anger. This doesn't mean we stuff anger, because I don't think, you know, it's not going to do me any good to play like I don't have it. Okay, that's not, you know, it's like, okay, just play like you don't have it. What happens is I have tools. I have step 10. I can start writing. I can immediately start to write that resentment down and just do a step 10, just right across the columns. I do step 10 just like I did a four step. And I can call my sponsor, or what I like to have, I don't know if any of you agree with this, but I happen to sponsor a lot of women, and we can't always, you know, keep up with the 10 steps. So we kind of have a 10 step buddy, and, you know, so somebody I can read 10 steps to. And if I can't get a hold of my sponsor, believe me, I will find somebody to read a 10 step to. Because this is how I stay current. This is how I stay up with what I'm doing, and certainly with things like anger. Love and tolerance is our code. Step 10 in the big book, that's in the step 10 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Should the compulsion get the upper hand, I need to get on my knees with a third step and start a 10th step immediately. These are the things that I have to do for anger. Now, whatever you do is fine, but I know me, and I know what kind of problems anger can cause. I know drinking anger could cause me to be a child abuser. That's what anger did. And I don't ever, ever, ever want to be that person again. And as long as I have the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to pick up those tools and use them. And I'd love to tell you that I do this every time before I, you know, say something really horrid to my husband. But, you know, he still gets really horrid things. But for the most part, I have been able to, with the help of the program and the help of you people and God's grace, just by asking for help, been able to have a lot of progress in the area of my anger. Intolerance: an emotional inebriate which fouls up 12-step work. It succeeds in blocking awareness of what has been shared with one in the program. It causes emotional biases and prejudice. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had not it been for such stupidity. And that's page 103 in the big book, and we read that last night at the Thursday night meeting. And I think one of the things that is very hard on people that we try to work with or that we try to help is intolerance. And I know sometimes I find myself intolerant of newcomers. They don't mind. You know, they just, you know, I find myself getting, losing my patience. Doing all those things I did is that abusive mom is that I start to do that. And I just feel like that we need, or at least I need to take a strong look at being tolerant and being willing to sometimes just listen to people. And one of my women called me one day and she said, "I just can't listen to that person any longer." And I said, "Gosh, they were just like you." And I know exactly how you feel. So, and you know, it's like, oh, I said, be a little tolerant. Be a little tolerant. My gosh, they're just trying to find their footing, you know. Be a little tolerant. Solution. Daily doses of live and let live plus an open mind. Seek to develop compassion. And compassion is the highest form of emotional maturity. Begin with steps 6 and 7. Step 10, love and tolerance is our code. We just read that one. In the big book, on page 86, it says, "We must be careful not to drift into remorse and morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others." So one of the things that I think we need to also do is if you find yourself being, being a little hard on people who you might should have been a little compassionate with, just don't drift. Maybe pick up the phone and say, "Okay, I was a little intolerant of you. I should have had, you know, more patience. And but if I start saying, 'Oh, I'm so horrible, I can't do this and I can't do that,' I'm not going to be of any use for anybody." So one of the things that I try to do is just try to not be so hard on myself when I make a mistake. And I'm one of these people that says if you're not making mistakes, a lot of mistakes, you're probably not doing enough. So, you know, because I'm a person who makes a lot of mistakes. And I have to be tolerant of that. I have to be tolerant of myself, and I have to be tolerant of others. And one of the things that I also find out is, you know, usually when I'm pointing my finger, they're pointing back at me. Usually the reason I'm very intolerant is because I expect perfection out of me, and consequently when I do that, expect it out of me, I'm expecting it out of you. And that I'm asking the impossible out of both of us, because that's a character defect for me. And that feeds right into all kinds of intolerance. So, let's see, I left one. What's the bottom of the page? Self-pity. Anybody have self-pity? Okay, put on my acting hat. One sip of this fairly slow-acting emotional intoxicant can lead to distorted perception. Giant mountains mushroom out of little tiny molehills. Problems are magnified and calamities loom on all sides. The drunkenness progresses to the crying stage and the dialogue runs. Nobody loves me. Nobody appreciates me. Nobody cares. Nobody recognizes how hard I try. Everybody's against me. I can't do anything right. I might as well be dead. Now that's an exaggeration, I'm sure. Set to a mournful tune, these lines are played over and over in a half-dark, gloomy, upset, unswept mental hangout. At the center of self-pity is a half-grown kid having a slobbering, blubbering temper fit at God, self, circumstances, and people. As long as we keep the drunk tears flowing, he does not have to leave and go out into the light. Self-pity is one of the most unhappy and consuming defects that we know. It is a bar to all spiritual progress and can cut off all effective communication with our fellows because of its inordinate demands for attention and sympathy. It is a maudlin form of martyrdom which we can ill afford. And that's on page 238 in As Bill Sees It. The solutions, steps 6 and 7. I got to look at this. You know, thank God that people in AA got in my face and told me the truth, whether I wanted to hear it or not. But if somebody told me I was in self-pity, I was just highly insulted. Now, I don't know about you. You probably just took it right in stride. I just, you know, how could you say that about me, that I have self-pity? Step 6 and 7 and the 11th step prayer in the big book on page 86. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that we be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And one of the things that I know is that I am the creator of my own misery. And I know, you know, it's like today I'm grateful for some barometers. You know, like if that kind of starts churning and I start, you know, one of these like, oh, I can't do anything right. Thank God I'm married to somebody in the program who has something to say. Thank God I go to a lot of AA meetings, and I can make a comment like that, you know, at one of my meetings. I don't know what happens at yours, but I can guess it's about the same since you guys are kind of responsive. I like that. And that is somebody's going to go, aw. Aw. Poor baby, she didn't get her way. You know, and that's usually what it is I just don't get what I want. And I'm going to just start down into that self-pity. And I'll have those faulty dependencies. I am depending on something to turn out the way I want it to. I'm depending on trying to get something I want, and I don't, so I'm disappointed. And then I'm going to go into self-pity. And I can assure you that if I start going on a pity trip, if I start doing that, it's not going to be long before I have spiraled down into depression. Because this head of mine, I don't know about you. I mean, I hope I'm not of no hope to the newcomer. But I don't know about you. But almost 29 years later, and my head is not my friend. It is not my friend. That's why I go to a lot of meetings. That's why I talk to a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I stay in the book. That's why I stay in the literature. Because I need to be here. I need to be doing these things. I don't know what it is. I don't know if I'm in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's or I've always had it, but I forget quickly. You know, I just have to keep doing it over and over. As the book says, repetition strengthens and confirms, and faith then comes naturally. I just have to do it over and over. I seem to have a really short stem about, you know, working stuff in AA. I have to do it all the time. I can't just do it once or twice a week. I have to do it all the time. Even though I go to a lot of meetings, I need to talk to a lot of people on the phone. I need to be doing a lot of service. I need to be doing the deal. I need to be doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if not, my head will, I'll start thinking. And if I start thinking and it's not good, here we go. Poor me. Poor me. So, self-pity. Resentment. How are we doing on time?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Resentment, emotional intoxicant distilled with character defects, guaranteed to impede progress in steps 3 and 11. Drinking of resentment poisons spiritual progress, often leads to emotional enslavement. One of the things that I have learned for me is that if I resent something, it attaches me to it. It just, I mean, I'm there on it all the time. It attaches me to it. It enslaves me to what I'm resentful of. I become its hostage, whatever it is. And the resentment can be people, places, or things. Now, I can get really angry. I can get on high horses about what people have done and how they behave. And I forget God's got a plan and it's none of my business. He didn't ask me about what I thought about it. I can get very upset and enslaved to political ideas. I'm really getting better about the political ideas. I have moved to Bellingham. I love Bellingham. It's a wonderful little town that I've moved to. But I'm here to tell you that it is stuck in the 60s. The hippies forgot to leave. It's still Birkenstocks and organic and all that. It's just so fun. And I've just learned, it's so many things I didn't really pay attention to. You know, it's like I lived in Southern California. I didn't really pay any attention to people who were hugging trees and doing these things, and it's just wonderful to watch this and to watch people be passionate about what they believe in. I love it, and I never paid attention to it. And what's really wonderful is I don't have to agree with them. That's what's even better, is that I can appreciate their passion. I can appreciate their enthusiasm. That's what I love that Larry, I loved what you said last night. That, we're not high strung and intense. We're enthusiastic. Are you? Something like that. And I just love that because, today I can appreciate that because that's what they are. They've got some ideas and they're enthusiastic about it. But I can remember when I would be totally attached and enslaved to any kind of resentment I had, whether it was political. Probably the most resentment that wasn't a person that I had that I brought into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was a resentment against the Baptist Church. I had a huge resentment. And I am so grateful for Clancy. I am so grateful for his tape, Alcoholism, A Disease of Perception. Because when I heard that tape, I realized that I don't hear things the way they really are. I don't see things the way they really are. I have a disease of perception. And I'm so glad that people are put in my life to help me see the truth, whether I want to or not. People love us here. People love us, and they're willing to get in our face and tell us the truth whether we want to hear it or not. But I had a huge resentment to the Baptist Church. Now, in my head, I thought that the Baptist Church wanted to kill me. That's what I thought. I thought that all this stuff, you're going to burn in hell. You're born a sinner. All of this stuff that it wasn't, I don't know where I was when they were talking about Jesus loves me. I miss that. But it just seemed like that's what I heard was this, and I'm sure that somewhere down in this little girl before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol was this need to be perfect. Having these expectations that I could never fulfill about myself. Are you having expectations? Other words, I wouldn't give anybody the right to make a mistake. If I saw somebody in that Baptist church make a mistake, then I was going to talk about them. I was going to say they were a hypocrite. See, they're not really what they say they are. Look what they did. other words, not allowing a person to even be human because they were a church member. Holding people to a standard that nobody could stand, that nobody could live up to. Holding people to that kind of a standard. And I brought that old idea of having to behave in a certain way because you say you're this, and not allowing a person to be human, I brought that character defect and that old idea into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and caused a lot of harm by gossiping and saying things about people that weren't true and holding them to a standard that they could not live up to. Yet, here I had done more or worse. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not the kind of person that should, I was not an example. I was having affairs in AA. I was doing things as a newly sobered person that was absolutely not a program of attraction, depending on what you were attracted to. But I was not a program of attraction. And then, in turn, would see people who I believed were people who were, you know, like the AA gurus or the people who were, you know, supposed to be the sober leaders, and hold them to a standard and judge them, and me be down here doing something else. That's exactly what I had done in that Baptist church, is held people to standards. And what happened is that resentment would enslave me to them, and it would churn me up. And then when I would get around them, I was uncomfortable. And I'm really grateful today that I've got some tools to help me deal with these kind of old ideas. How are we doing?
A couple minutes.
Okay. I'm going to finish this one up then. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. That's huge. It stems all forms of spiritual disease. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When this malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And one of the things that I know about me is I've had I talked about depression, I had some physical, I guess anxiety would be physical, but as I began to grow, and I'm telling you, I'm a slow learner. I am a slow learner. I sponsor women who are so far ahead of me, but I really started to take a turning point when I was 12 years sober. And I know that, you know, most people are doing a lot better than that. They're doing a lot better than that. Harboring resentment is infinitely grave. That's a huge word. Infinitely grave. That sounds like that might just kill you. For then we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And that's in As Bill Sees It. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. Now Bill used that word again. And that's in the big book on page 66. The solution. The fourth step, I would think, don't you? Do a little fourth step on some of these resentments. If you've done a fourth step, tenth step, you know, because I'd love to tell you that I'm resentment free, but I'm one of them that, you know, I collect them along the way. You know, I get rid of the ones that I came in here with and took the necessary action and did the amends and did. But, you know, I just keep creating new ones. And it's amazing that I have to keep doing this work. The four-step prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Now, I can tell you that when I was working I don't work anymore. There are some fabulous advantages to being old. I still get a paycheck. You know, if you hang around and you pay into Social Security, when you get old, they'll pay you back. Anyway, that prayer, I always had to be work tolerance and had resentments in the workplace. It just seemed like people just did not live up to my expectations of how they should do things. And I put that prayer on my computer. It was my screensaver for a very long time because I would have to refer to it over and over because I would get so intolerant. I worked for an HMO, and I don't know if you have them up here, but I could get very intolerant with doctors, with patients, with employees. I mean, it just seemed like a breeding ground for resentments. And so what I would try to do is to keep that prayer up because if not, I mean, you know, I could just start churning and just ruin my day by some resentment that had nothing to do with me, wasn't going to benefit my life at all in, you know, the next day or 30 minutes from now, and cause myself to create a lot of misery that's going to cause me to be anxious, depressed, feel bad, yell at my best friend, you know, call my husband dirty names, you know, all of those things that I don't need to do just because I am intolerant, and that intolerance breeds resentment. So let's take a drink. Oh, my God! What is that about? Let's take a break. Oh, gee. Now, I don't know if any of this is on your six-step list, but it was definitely on mine. Jealousy. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with the most terrible human emotion, jealousy. That's page 82 in the big book. The greatest enemies of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. And that's on page 145 of the big book. Take a drink of jealousy, and you can destroy a relationship. Take a drink of jealousy, you can destroy an AA group. Take a drink of jealousy, and somebody's life may be at stake because it causes such debris falls from jealousy. I am a person that has had a lot of problems with jealousy. And I have always felt, you know, if you had a lot of money and you were really pretty and you had really, you know, nice clothes and stuff like that, I had a lot of jealousy of that. I wanted that. But the biggest jealousy I've had, and I don't have it so much, I don't have it anymore. I've recovered from the jealousy in this area. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't still pop up, and I'll share some things that still pop up. But the biggest jealousy I dealt with is when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I had married, absolutely, and I still feel like this, the best man in AA, absolutely the most gorgeous man in AA. And at that time, I was, you know, as the years went on, probably about 5 or 6 years, 10 years of sobriety, I was sponsoring some women. And my husband really liked these women. He liked them. And all of these women, you know, were younger than me. And worst of all, they were thinner than me. And I was so jealous. I was jealous of Dave's attention to these women. And a lot of them were my sponsees. And I was just envious and jealous of everything they were and had. And it nearly ate me alive. Fortunately, I have a husband who has a really good program. And this was the one that ate me up the most. I've been jealous of other things, but this is the one that was the worst character defect. He looked at me and he said, "Polly, I am so sorry that you have such a hard time with my relationship with other women. But I am a faithful husband, and I am not going to do anything to violate the covenant of this marriage. But I will not cease being friends with people just because of how it affects you." Now, I'm grateful that he had enough self-worth to do that. Because, you see, what I could have done is alienated him by my jealousy from friends with people who are now he's still friends with. I still sponsor these people. And how my jealousy could have totally annihilated those relationships. Today, you know, when I go off, you know, talking, and I've been doing this for, you know, for a lot of years, and my husband, his thing to me is, because it's not Dave's issue, his thing to me is, you go be the best you can be. You go be the best you can be. And then what I would do is I would want him to act differently. And I'm really grateful today that I am not eaten alive by that. Because I'm telling you, that character defect of jealousy nearly ate my lunch. I watched that character defect in my family today. I watched that character defect sometimes in my sons. I watch sometimes my oldest son has some problems with you know, being jealous because of some of the things that's going on with his brother. It's a horrible thing. It eats us alive. It nearly ate my lunch. Now, I wish I could say I never have that feeling, but you know, somebody can walk in here with a Coach bag and a pair of Cole Haan shoes on. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, I can still get that. I ought to be able to have that. You know, and I can feel jealous. But it's not that soul-rotting jealousy. Absolutely, that rots the soul away. Because the jealousy that I had was absolutely rotting my soul. And I have watched people, I have sponsored people who have had jealousy that has caused a lot of problems. It has caused women to do horrible things to men. Because they may be jealous because of, you know, relationships that split up and now they're in a relationship somewhere else, or marriages that split up and they're in a marriage somewhere else. And that jealousy has absolutely held them, and now they're just, some of them are just bitter old women because of nothing but jealousy. What's the solution? Recovery is possible through daily attention to spiritual needs. One of the things that I know for me is that I just absolutely had to pay attention constantly to my spiritual condition. I had to pray. I had to meditate. I had to keep reading books that would talk about jealousy, things that would keep talking with my sponsor, keep telling on myself. One of the things that I need to do for me is I need to tell on myself. And sometimes it takes a little public humiliation, because that's what happens with me. I can have one of my character defects out of whack. And, you know, sometimes the only thing it gets to a person like me is some public humiliation. And you know what? People don't do it to me. I do it to myself. I have, as you just saw, I have no problem in publicly humiliating myself, and I can do it when it's not funny. You know, when it's not just a slip of the tongue. I can do something that's really hurtful and harmful if I don't stay close to God and close to this program. And it's a lot of times it'll be sometimes out of jealousy. Humility, a word often misunderstood. To those who have made progress in AA, it amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. That's in the 12 and 12. And one of the things that that I try to do is I try to stay clear with my sponsor. I really try to stay clear with the people I sponsor. Especially if they're going through something, like if they're having some jealousy problems or if they're having intolerance or they're having some of the other stuff that's going on, I share my own experience, strength, and hope. Because one of the things that I truly believe is the only thing I have to offer another alcoholic is my experience. That's all I have to offer, is my experience. And a lot of times I wanted to share, you know, I think I need to share something else, and I'll start getting a little philosophical and telling them something else. And you know, it just, when I stop sharing my experience, like the reading we read last night, share my experience, strength, and hope. That's what I need to be sharing. And I certainly have a lot of it around jealousy. And it has been my experience that when I am jealous, it is going to cause me to be spiritually unfit. It is going to take me and separate me from the sunshine of the Spirit. And it's going to cause me to do things that I am going to be so ashamed of. And one of them is it's probably going to cause me to say things about people that aren't true. Because what happens a lot of times if I get jealous is I'm going to end up putting somebody, if I'm jealous of a person, is I'm going to end up putting them down to make myself look better. And once I do that, I have just absolutely taken a big bite out of one of God's kids. I don't think when I do things like that makes God happy. I just don't think that makes him happy when I talk about his kids and say bad things. And usually what I do is, for me, is it's, you know, something's going on. Somehow or another, I got to make myself look better. And it's usually somehow around some jealousy. Dishonesty and self-deception. Emotional intoxicants. You know, I'm usually the last to know. I don't know about you. I can, one of the things that, am I doing something wrong?
Just going to go get a drink.
Just going to go get a drink. You know, when the man rocks across, he gets my attention, you know, that's... That's a lot of sobriety walking there. A lot of sobriety. What happens with self-deception is I'm going to be doing something that's out of line, and I am going to defend it to the death. One of the things, you know, I have done some things, and Dottie will look at me and she'll say, and she's very sweet. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't get harsh, and she'll say, Polly, that doesn't sound like a really good idea to me. That's the way she puts it. It just doesn't sound like a good idea. Have you thought that through? And I will defend that because I've got this idea that somehow I'm self-deceived and I'm dishonest. And have you ever called your sponsor? Now, I know none of you do this. And you're getting ready. Now, I have an out-of-town sponsor. And I sponsor a lot of women out of town as well. And so I will call her, and I will be giving her some information. Yeah, but I'm a little dishonest. I've got a spin on it that's not quite right. Not quite right. And so we'll, you know, we'll talk about it for a while. And she's been my sponsor for 25 years, so she knows me pretty well. And she'll, you know, we'll start talking about it. And then the next thing, she's so funny. The next thing she does, she'll go into this cackle. Dottie's got this laugh that will just cause your nerves to stand on end. And she'll start this cackle and she'll say, "I know what it is, I know what it is." And the last one, I got to tell you, last week I was in Whitefish, Montana, and I have trouble sleeping. And so I called her up, and I had to do a workshop. I hadn't had about a couple hours sleep, and I'm just, what am I going to do? I can't sleep, you know, and I called her up, and I was just, you know, got this little twist on it, you know, like, I don't know what's the matter, and she wants to know how much coffee I'm drinking, you know, all this kind of stuff. She's asking too many questions, and pretty soon, she is so cute. She starts laughing, and she says, "I know what it is. God wants to talk to you. Just get up and talk to him." And I'm like, what? But you know, and she kind of afterwards, she says, "Stop fighting. Go into the book. Cease fighting. We read it last night. Cease fighting. Just don't fight it. Just, you know, God's going to give you whatever you need. If you need more energy, he's going to give it to you. You just, you know, your problem is, Polly, you don't trust it. So you just don't trust." So then I get, you know, all of a sudden that anxiety, you know, that anxiousness that you got, you know, all of a sudden when you've got this problem and it's not going to go right and I need to change it and something, all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot. God's going to give me exactly what I need. All I need to do is just trust. Oh, okay. You want to talk to me? Then I'll get up and talk to you. No, but just get some, and that's what's so great about her, because I don't care what it is or what we're talking about, Dottie's going to get it right back to what we were talking about, that letter, that don't depend, you know, there are no faulty dependencies. I better put my dependency on God, and she's going to pull it right back for me to have my dependencies on God. So, if you don't have a sponsor, I love what you guys say. If you don't have a sponsor, get one. Because I can tell you that there are times, you know, as long as I've been sponsored, that I need a sponsor. I absolutely need a sponsor. And one of the things that I've also found out is that, you know, there are times that I can call Dottie and I won't get her for weeks. I'll call and I'll call and I'll call, and usually it's because I'm calling her to fuss at her because she needs to quit work, which is none of my business. She's the sponsor, and because I worry about her, and but I'll call her and I won't get her, but just let me need her, and she answers the phone. I don't know how that works. I do not know how that works, but that's a God deal. It's an absolute God deal. So if you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor. Because as long as I've been sober, they're still so important. Sponsors are so important. I just don't know what I would do if I didn't have that backup. I just don't know what I'd do if I didn't have a sponsor to show me how to walk through. My sponsor's just now got through showing me how to walk through cancer and how you can do it and just, you know, just have a great attitude, be, you know, totally there. You know, sponsors show us how to do life. They show us how to do it. Criticism. This is a terrible one. I'm really good at this. a social cocktail made with equal parts of rumor, gossip, and a secret glee over others' misfortune. Really, sometimes it feels really good to do that, to criticize. I like to throw gossip in there too, because that's another criticism. I don't believe there's any such thing as constructive criticism. I think criticism is intended to hurt. When I get ready to be critical, all I have to do is check it right here. And usually when I'm criticizing, I'm coming from a place of anger. I'm angry, and I'm criticizing you to somehow put you down. I'm not being helpful. I'm not trying to point out something that's going to help you. I'm not coming from a place of love. My first AA sponsor told me one time, he says, "Polly, you can tell anybody anything, and they can hear you if you tell it with love. But when you don't, they know." And it cuts, you know, it just cuts. And there's a difference to me when I go and I criticize somebody and I kind of slice them open to when, you know, I say something that's truthful because I love you. And then you can hear it. And right, you know, when you say the truth and the person hears the truth, you know, the truth is apt to piss you off first, okay? It'll set you free, but it's apt to piss you off first. But the thing about it is when a person hears that, they know it. They can feel it. It goes in. A person, I don't know why it is, but we can feel that. But when I go in to criticize somebody, you know, it's the person will even say, you know, "God, what," you know, they'll question me, especially my husband. That's my biggest teacher. Because you see, all my nasty character defects get worked out on him. That's where they get worked out on the most. In fact, Dave has, the other day he said this. I was criticizing him about something. And he just looks at me, those of you who know Dave, he's so loving. And Dave looked at me and he says, "Polly, I love you so much. I don't want to change a hair on your head. Why is it so necessary that you have to continue to criticize me and try to change me?" Whew. Now, that's true. That's the truth. I just, you know, there's certain things I think Dave ought to do, and, you know, I try to get him socially adapted. And one of the things that I've found out is I just need to just let him alone. Dave is, we were laughing about this at breakfast, Nicole and her mother and I. My husband we don't know who comes down and picks him up and takes him off into space. But somebody comes now and then and takes him off. And he just sort of leaves the planet, and other people think that he's mad at them. And he's not mad, he just left. You know? He's just gone somewhere. And if you wait a little while, he'll come back. You know, and he'll look around, and he just, you know, he likes computers, he's a computer geek, and he kind of gets sucked into them, and he leaves for a while. But people would come up to me and say, "Is Dave mad at me?" and all of that stuff. And thank God, I finally grown up enough to say, you know what, it's just, I don't know, go talk to Dave about that. It's not my day to watch him. So, but I used to have to go to the meeting and make sure that he's going to be socially okay. You know, like that was my responsibility. And my criticism. So, anyway, criticism can be really, really harmful. So, what I try to do is I try to think of something. If I'm getting ready to say something, I try to really say something nice about someone. And you know what? I have learned, if I'll just take the action and say something nice, I don't need to mean it. I really don't need to mean it. I just need to take the action. And what happens is if I take the action and I keep saying those nice things and trying to have nice thoughts and try to quit criticizing, you know, pretty soon I do feel that way. It's amazing. If I just take the actions, pretty soon it becomes a truth. It becomes a reality. Fear. Anybody got fear in here? Whew. Nothing is more self-centered than fear. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It causes more trouble. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was driven by 100 forms of fear. I was afraid of everything. I was a military wife, and I was afraid of people who were more sophisticated, more educated than me. I felt like I would never fit in. I would never measure up. I've always had that feeling, and today I call it alcoholism. I've always had that feeling of just not quite being enough. Now, I'd like to tell you that that feeling's gone, but it can creep over me on any given day. And one of the things that I have learned is that if I want to have self-esteem, I have to do an esteemable act. And I have always been afraid of people. And I have always been afraid of what they were going to think of me. Nothing self-centered about me. You know, what are you going to think of me? When it's none of my business. I need to be thinking about you. And that's, I always worried about that to the point that it would paralyze me. And one of the things that it's just like talking like I am doing right now. I have not had any kind of training or anything this is just AA. You know, I went to the podium participation meeting that you had last night. That's how I began to be able to stand up in front of people. Somebody asked me, are you nervous? Oh yeah, I'm nervous. I'm always nervous. Sometimes I can't clear my throat. So, you know, things like that. I'm nervous. I don't know how. I'm the kid that couldn't stay. I would take an F in school before I would stand up in front of a class and give a book report. That's the kind of kid I am. But you are the people in Alcoholics Anonymous said, if you're afraid, we'll be here. You stand up and do that anyway. And we'll help you walk through that fear. If you're afraid of this, we'll help you do it. We'll help you walk through your fear. And I've had a lot of fears in sobriety. I had a fear of driving in downtown L.A. when I moved there. I was terrified. And, you know, there was people in AA who said I was new to the area, and they said, we'll get in the car with you, and we'll help you. And that's been my experience in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what I need to do? If I'm going to get some help from you, I need to tell you what I'm afraid of. I need to tell you. Walking through fear is exercising faith. Now, I've heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And I don't believe that. I believe that I can have a fear, and with your help, you'll give me enough faith to walk through it. That's what I believe. I believe that we are here to help each other walk through our fears, to help us see that some fears are just, what, future events appear real, but there's not. And one of the things that helps me is that if I go in and I'm really anxious, maybe I've got some financial fear, I've got some fear about what's happening to one of my kids, their sickness, whatever fear's going on, and I come into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know somebody's going to take a hold of me and just say, you know something, sweetheart? Nothing bad's happening to you right now. You just say right here in the moment, and there's nothing to be afraid of. And they'll help me exercise faith by walking through that fear. And where I get that from is the solution. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us to be. Then it says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. I'm not out. I'm still commencing with my fears, a lot of them. But what happens is I continue to try to get you to help me exercise faith to walk through those fears. The big book says on page 86 and 84, after making a review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. So what happens is that I'm not, this is going to go on. I have to review my fears. I have to take a look at them, write about them. That's what a tenth step is. And I don't know if you guys, you know, get 10-step buddies so you'll be sure to get rid of them really quick or get with your sponsors or what have you. But one of the things I try to do, I'm not really good at it all the time, but I try to do a daily 10th step. Now, I sponsor a woman in Georgia who is so faithful with 10th steps. She does one every single night. I wish I could tell you I was that good at it, but I'm not. But what happens is I'm usually really doing 10 steps just as, you know, as soon as I get a knot in my stomach. I'll get a knot in my stomach and oh my gosh, I know, right? That's the barometer. Something's wrong with me. If I get a knot in my stomach, it's not about somebody else. It's about me. What am I doing that I need to correct right now? So I need to review it. Ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measurements should be taken. Now, I wonder who I could inquire to help me besides God. How about a sponsor? That I could call a sponsor and inquire about what it is that I could do to help with this fear. Give me a corrective measure that I could take for this fear. Okay. Blame. Anybody ride the blame train? Somebody else's fault? I'm this way because my mom, my dad, you know, my boss did it to me. You know, my creditors want my money. As John A. says, no, they don't want your money. They want their money. You know, blaming is a way that I don't have to take responsibility for my own actions. And I am so grateful that I did not come from alcoholic parents. I somehow feel like a person like me who never ever wanted to take responsibility for my own actions, had I come from alcoholic parents, I just wonder if I'd be sober today. But what happened was is my parents were an alcoholic. And I could not blame my alcoholism on them. I couldn't even blame, you know, I looked at people in Alcoholics Anonymous and they, you know, they were telling some stories that I couldn't even believe, especially about their childhood. I don't know if any of you have ever been to treatment, you know, where they sit around and talk about their feelings. Anyway, you know, sit still, you'll have another one later. But they would talk about their feelings, and they would tell about these horrific things, which is not funny, that happened to little boys and girls. And I would say, well, God, I can understand why you're an alcoholic, but why am I an alcoholic? Because those things didn't happen to me. And one of the things that I know, because I am an abusive parent, I know that child abuse has a strong effect. It traumatizes children. I know because my children were traumatized by a disease called alcoholism. I know that it traumatizes children. But the deal is that if I could fix it, if I could make my kids right by whatever, I'd do it. I would do it today, but I can't. I can't. I once heard an AA speaker say that all your problems have my name on it, but all your solutions have yours. There is nothing I can do to make it different. I can't. I would love to take away that. Now, I have a son who's sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he has some tools. He has a lot of tools and he has worked through that. I have another son who absolutely believes with all his heart that he has no anger and that nothing that bad happened to him. And he believes that because he is unwilling to take a look and get down to those causes and conditions that we have in steps 4 and 5. So the anger won't leave. You know, I'd love to wish all that stuff away. I'd love to take anger and wish it away. But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that we have a process, and I have to do that process. And that is, I've got to do an inventory. And then I've got to admit it to another person, to God, and to myself. And then it tells me I need to look at my character defects. And it tells me that I need to ask God to remove those character defects. Then I need to make a list of the people I've hurt. And then I need to go make amends. And I don't know another process to do that can get me through all that. But somewhere, no matter what kind of hurt has happened to me, I have caused a hurt too. I have caused a hurt. And one of the things that I want to say, if there's anybody here that has had child abuse and some really horrible things that have happened to you, maybe the only responsibility that I have to that is to just, because kids, they're blameless. So a child is blameless. But if I am sitting right here, 45 years old, and that is still eating my lunch, I need to do some work. I absolutely need to do some work. And all I can say is that if that is you, there is hope here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is hope. If we do this work, and I know for me that when I sponsor someone who has this particular kind of a background, I sponsor enough other people that have the experience that can help those people through that experience. And talk about blame and becoming forgiving and then having no blame. I have a woman I sponsor, and I just love to share her story because I think it's such a story of hope. And she helps me when I work with people who have this problem because it's not my experience. And when it's not my experience, I need to get someone who is their experience. Because these people are blaming, and that blame keeps us paralyzed in the sickness. And what happens is this lady had suffered some incest from her father. And what happens was, because of this work, she was able to get through that and forever love him until the day he died and forgive him for what happened. Now, she also was a responsible mom. She never, ever left her two children with her father, unless she was there. She never left him. But what happened was she worked through that. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful when we can get to that place of forgiveness, because to forgive is divine. When we forgive, it is so powerful, that gift of forgiveness, when that pain and all of that is just lifted up from doing this work. When we take those steps and work them, it doesn't matter how bad it is or what's gone down in our life, these steps work. And they heal. They heal wounds that should never be healed. They heal. That's what these steps do. Page 62 of the big book, it says, "So, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Whatever is going on, I am the creator of my own misery. We think that our problems are basically of our own making. If I can take responsibility, and that responsibility again may be just doing the work, because I do not think children have a part, but doing the work. And sometimes because of things that have happened to us, we go around and we hurt other people." Al-Anon has a statement in the ODAF that says that hurt people hurt people. That if I've been hurt, I'm apt to turn around and hurt somebody else. And one of the things that I like about, I have a woman that I sponsor by the name of Michael. And when Michael talks about her story, she says, "Before I tell you my story, let me tell you my mother's story, because her story is worse than mine." And Michael's is bad enough, but her story is worse than mine. So when I can start to see some compassion to somebody who hurt me, who was so hurt themselves, then I start to get that powerful, powerful gift. And that's the gift of compassion. The gift of compassion to see that that person was harmed. And because of their harm, they've harmed me. And in doing so, I get to look at that and inventory it and be able to reach that wonderful place of forgiveness. Depression. This has been my probably major character defect. You ever been around anybody that's depressed? It's disgusting. It is disgusting. There is nothing you can do for them. And one of the things that I've learned, and one of the things that every time I do this workshop, there's somebody that comes up to me. So let me just make this clear. I'm not a doctor. I don't do stuff with whatever goes on between you and a doctor, and if where medication and all that stuff, I don't have an opinion on that. That's just whatever. I'm just going to share my experience, strength, and hope. The other thing is that I make this statement. I believe it for me. You don't have to believe it. I believe depression is the most self-centered act we have. It is nothing but about self. It is all about self. And now somebody, I don't know if anybody's going to come up here, but I'm going to tell you right now, if you do, it's okay. Always somebody does. But what about clinical depression? I don't know. I don't know about, I'm not a doctor. All I'm going to talk about is depression, the way it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, depression as Bill talks about it, and the language of the heart, and depression as I've experienced it. And I've experienced depression to the point of self-mutilation and suicide. And I'm here to tell you today, I lead a pretty darn good life because of doing what this program tells me to do. And I am so grateful for that. And what I do is I do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things, the biggest thing that I do is work with another alcoholic. That's it. That's what I have to do. And that's what Bill's last thing was in that letter. When all else fails, go work with another alcoholic. You know, I am one of these people that sponsors a lot of women. Now, I haven't a clue what I do for them. I don't know what I do for them. But I can tell you right now, if it weren't for them, I may die. Because I am a person who cannot spend any time thinking about myself. I can't. I've got a head that is not my friend. I absolutely have a head that is not my friend. And if I spend any time in that head, it's going to take me down, because I'm going to start getting some self-pity. I'm just going to know you got it better than me. You know, you got a house and you got two new cars and you're thin and I'm not. Of course, I'm not willing to work out and do what you have to do to get thin. And, I'm going to start. And I'm going to start having, that's what happens to me when I have too much time on my hands. I start thinking. But if I'm talking to another alcoholic, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about constant thoughts of others. I wish I could think about you without talking to you. But somehow or another, you just don't quite come to my mind. it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. So if I'm talking to you on the phone, it's amazing. I'm thinking about you. And it works. It absolutely works. And I'm a person who returns phone calls. I do that. I call other people. I've never gotten too sober to not call another alcoholic. I call people. And if you're sponsored by me and I don't hear from you, I check up on you. Dave talks about getting my ducks all in a line. You know, I got to figure out where you're at if I haven't heard from you for a while. I need that. And you know, it may help somebody else, and I hope it does, but it definitely saves my life. Because what happens for me is depression is all about me. It's all about me. And if you've been around anybody who's depressed, there is nothing you can do for them because they are so far into self that whatever you try to do, whatever love, and I'm telling you from experience, this is my experience, whatever try to give them, whatever help you're going to try to do, whatever you're trying to make them laugh, whatever you're trying to do, they cannot feel it. They cannot feel it. They are totally, when I am depressed, I am shut off from the sunshine of the Spirit. I cannot feel the love. I can't feel it. Now, what are solutions? What's the solutions? One of the things is I get huge doses of attitude or gratitude. Well, that's cute to say, isn't it? Let's get an attitude of gratitude. You want to tell me how to do that? Yeah, you know, how do you do that? How am I supposed, I'm here and I'm depressed. I can't get up out of, you know, I can't move. The world's against me. Everybody hates me. You know, I'm just, nobody loves me. Where the whole world loves me, but I think they don't. And I'm supposed to have an attitude of gratitude. How do I get that? For me, I know there's some actions I have to take. One of them is if I'm in bed, get up. Get up. I say this to women all the time. And, you know, there's nothing more draining. There's nothing more annoying. There's nothing more intolerant than somebody who's depressed. You ever been around somebody who's depressed? It is tough. Guess what I get a ton of? Depressed women. You know why? Because God's got a sense of humor. I've got experience. So what I do, what was told to me, I'll talk on the phone to somebody, get up. Get in the shower. Go take a walk. Call somebody. You ever pick up a phone and it weighs 200 pounds? Oh, God. And don't ask ask about them. And if they ask about you, don't tell them. Don't tell them. You've already told me. You don't need to ruin somebody else's day. Don't tell them. Just ask about them. And it begins to work. We begin to move out of depression. I know today that being in service in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. If you don't have depression, then you probably, it's not going to be something you know anything about. But if you do, I know that I need to stay busy with other alcoholics. I know that what has saved my life is one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. The magic, the language of the heart. What heals us is talking to each other. Dr. Bob said if you took this program and boiled it down, it would be two words, love and service. One of my favorite heroes died not long ago, a man by the name of Don Pritz. And Don was a beautiful, beautiful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I happened to be with him shortly before he died. And he spoke and he said, you know, if I can give you any gift, all I can tell you is just be kind to each other. Just be kind. Just let us be kind to each other. You know, all of us have come in here and we've had enough hurt. Let's just be kind to each other. Let's love each other. And I'm so grateful that You know, I've learned things like that. And if anything, I mean, I try my best, you know, especially with people who are suffering depression. I wish God wouldn't send so many of them to me, you know, but it's my experience. But I know that that's what happens. And I know people were very tolerant of me. They were very tolerant when I didn't want to, you know, do things, and I didn't want to get up, and I didn't want to do the things that were suggested. I just felt like I couldn't move, and they tried to love me, and I couldn't feel the love. But what they didn't do, and I think what we don't do in these rooms, is we don't give up. We just absolutely don't give up. We don't give up. We keep on, you know, trying to help people no matter what. We just keep on trying to help people. And I'm so grateful that that's what people have done for me. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Bill says in his story, I was to know happiness, peace, and a usefulness and a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as it passes. And that's what I've learned. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking. No, we are twisted. You know, when somebody says we're twisted, we are. Twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkle. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is the most powerful health restorative. I don't know anything that is more spiritual than one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. I don't know what is more spiritual than to reach out and help another person. That is the greatest gift I think we are given in Alcoholics Anonymous, to sit down and take a person through the book, sit down and listen to a person's fifth step, and give that person your time and your attention and your love. I don't think there is anything more valuable to me than for somebody to have the confidence to entrust all of that to me. That is a gift. And what happens for me is because of that trust and that gift that that person has given me and that willingness to call me on the phone and talk to me or allow me to call them back has saved my life. Because I am a person without this program who is going to be somewhere overdosed with pills, cutting myself up with a razor blade, trying to take my life. That's me without the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But because of this program and because of the steps and because of what you've taught me, today I have a life of usefulness, and for that I am grateful. And today I know a little bit, just a little, but I know a little about emotional sobriety. Thank you.